This is Screen Divers. On this week's episode, we are talking about Old Henry. This movie is directed by Pozzi Ponsiroli, written by Pozzi Ponsiroli, produced by Shannon Hutchins and Mike Haggerty, and starring Tim Blake Nelson, Scott Hayes, Gavin Lewis, Trace Adkins, and Stephen Dorff. Cinematography by John Matsiak, edited by Jamie Kilpatrick, music by Jordan Lenning, produced by Hideout Pictures, and distributed by Shout Studios. This movie was released in 2021. It has a running time of 99 minutes. It was made in the United States. It was made for $1.5 million. And it raked $42,068, which is a damn shame. How are you guys?
Oh, I'm okay. Yeah. How you doing?
I'm great.
I'm all right. Ricky, you picked this movie. Well done.
I did pick this movie.
Yeah, yes, well done.
A good movie. This is a very good movie.
Yes, it is.
I would like to open this episode by making a little statement that will aid our listeners in enjoying this movie, perhaps to a higher level. As you may know, I mean, at least on this side of things, I think that there's a very interesting quality to American folklore and mythology. And sometimes, because the way history was recorded as well, that can be a little bit nebulous, particularly when we're talking about figures that populated what we would refer to as the Wild West. The main character in this movie, what's his name, guys?
Old Henry.
Now, if you don't know anything about Henry McCarthy, or if you do know who Henry McCarthy was, if you don't know who Henry McCarthy was, I suggest that you do not look it up. We can instantly recommend this movie, at least I do. I think Ricky does as well, because he recommended this movie to us. Mm-hmm. Steve, you were next to me when we watched it. We all enjoyed this movie.
This is great.
So for the sake of full enjoyment, if you don't know who Henry McCarthy was, I advise you to stop listening to the podcast now and watch the movie. Because this movie kind of relies on a little bit of a twist in the tale. And not entirely, but if you don't know who Henry McCarthy was, stop listening now. Watch the movie and then come back to the podcast. If you do automatically know who Henry McCarthy was and that name rings the bell, then keep listening. You'll enjoy the movie anyway. You'll enjoy the movie regardless, but I think it's a little extra touch here. And I think they took the liberty of making it such a pivotal point of this movie because the recorded history is so nebulous when it comes down to this kind of fusion of mythology and actual historical events.
Just before we carry on to that, I just also want to add that this film is widely available. I don't know how you guys watched it, but there's at least three or four streaming services in Australia that have this movie. You really don't have an excuse not to watch this movie.
Absolutely. And regardless of you being into Westerns or not, like it's performance driven, the story is solid, you should definitely go out of your way to watch it. And now a quintessential question must be asked. Ricky, what's this movie about?
Welcome to 1906 Oklahoma Territory, where a farmer is tending to his land. And due to a fact that he finds somebody who is being chased by a posse, decides to assist this person who is injured at home, only to find out that there's a lot more going on with the posse than he first realized, and it involves a lot of money.
I would go a little bit further and just say this is a father and son tale.
This is truly
a father and son tale.
It is. It's
great.
Yeah. This is an excellent movie, by the way. I really enjoyed it.
I mean, the fact that we sat down, we looked at the art direction on this movie straight away, and we were like, hang on, is this movie supposed to be shot in black and white? We literally took screenshots and toned down
to Ricky. Yeah.
Yeah, send it to Ricky. Because the art direction is absolutely stunning. I mean, whoever did Wrecking on the area, really set it up because it's perfect.
It felt natural to just go to the settings bar on my remote control and just take the color out of it just to see if we were right, and we were definitely right. I mean, you know, this movie is full of sepia tones, and I think they went out of their way to have this muted kind of colors on purpose, because that's possibly, you know, if you looked at any, how can I put it? First of all, it's the time of the year as well in which it's shot.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of a colorless, like burnt out kind of land. And it looks, everything looks a little bit hopeless as well. I like how honest this movie comes across as well about certain things. Like allegedly old Henry was 47 years old. Which, I'm 48, and we look better than that. But obviously, medical advancements weren't there. There was no diets were completely different. You would have been dead by then. So 47 is possibly old, right?
And without talking about anything further than what we've just talked about, if you think about how much the land takes a toll on somebody who's just trying to create their own business, to create their own farm. Of course, you're going to end up looking like that back in 1906.
Fucking hard work. Even Steve actually said that out loud. Yeah. They're digging this ditch and you'll feel it. You're feeling it.
And what's really great about this is that at that moment where they're digging the ditch at the very start of the movie, they drop that little nugget, that little seed that, you know, they're making machineries now that does this in half the time. And it's that we are in that crossover period of America where people are moving towards the industry era. They're moving towards machinery.
The 1900s.
For our listeners, this movie takes place on the eve of the Industrial Revolution, pretty much. It is right before the world takes, you know, a very important turn, basically, the Western world. The movie's set in 1906. This movie is entirely shot in Tennessee, but it's meant to take place where, Ricky?
Oklahoma
City. Our main protagonist, there's a voiceover at the beginning, which, by the way, Tim Blake Nelson, what a performance, man. Mm-hmm. He's fantastic He's also the executive producer of this movie. It's his money. Yeah. So it is a vehicle for an actor to do what he wants to do, and he did well. He gets a ton of screen time in this as well.
Is this the first COVID movie we've talked about on the podcast?
I think it is, because it was postponed 6 months during COVID, which helped the actual.
So they had to stop shooting.
It was pre-production when COVID hit.
Yeah.
Oh wow. Okay. It got a Venice release, and then a month later, a global release, allegedly, or at least in the United States, it was released. It's a shame, because that those numbers that we threw at our listeners at the beginning are kind of symptomatic of something. And that something is people, you know, it was first lockdown, second lockdown, even if it was getting a theatrical release, which probably didn't, but if it did, it's a disaster. How are you going to distribute this movie? You know what I mean? Like, it's...
Yeah.
And you could easily argue as well that all streaming services got, you know, a major, major boost from people staying at home throughout that period. So the world changed dramatically. You know, you could argue that. And even if we're past it, there's no way back, pretty much.
And you could also argue that this film is very akin to that as well, because in the film, we're about to have a major change to the world landscape. Yeah. And this feels like the last area that hasn't been touched by the industrial era or the new America that's coming around the corner.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. The movie looks gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous. It's well framed. And, you know, the performances are very good. Even Steven Dorff, man. I got
a point about that myself, because he's, you know, he has had some good roles and he has been a good actor, but then sometimes he's dialed it in, you know.
I think he had a penchant for certain substances as well. You could see it on him. I think his career kind of took a turn, but how difficult is it to keep it together when you're that young in this industry? You know, like I get it. You're still working, and apparently, you know, when I was looking around for some factoids about this movie and this and that, he did a ton of westerns, man. He's in a ton of westerns. Ozzy Ponciroli, this was his first feature. Not bad at all.
Really hitting the button. Just absolutely hitting the button on this.
Yes, and I like to think that he worked. It seems Tim Blake Nelson is an executive producer on this, and it's mostly his vehicle, right? So I think that this is an example of something where an actor has perspective or enough of it and enough experience and has worked enough to kind of, you can see that there's a hand in there. You know what I mean? You can see his performance seems like something that an actor gets to do when they're happy with their own take. Yeah. That's what I picked up from it.
Yeah, I think with this one, it was fortuitous and also unfortuitous. Like, they did 6 months of pre-production, and then I'm guessing COVID hit or COVID was happening, and so it all got delayed. So actually, they got like an additional 6 months to work on the script, and
not just the script, but the acting choices and everything else. Tim did an interview on this. I mean, he's a great actor, and so regularly underused as a secondary character and stuff like that.
He's a supporting actor mainly.
Yeah.
He's the protagonist here, which makes him a lead, but it's his money. So he got to do that, right?
Yeah.
And I agree with what you're saying. Like he deserves more, but at the same time, he doesn't have the looks of a leading man. And this is the reality of it.
That's correct. Yeah.
But he does have very strong particular features. He's perfect for this role. But also, you got to be careful if you start being the lead in roles where then your looks also have to take. So he's aware, he's a great supporting actor, character actor. And his performance is excellent. And there's also some choices that have been made in this movie, not just but from a narrative standpoint, and they are really clever. Every single time there's an interrogation scene here, there's a duality to it because he's intervening by aiding somebody, but it's also torturing them and getting information out of them. I love that. It happens twice in this. His interrogation methods are akin to someone who has done this, either during a stint in the army, which is the misdirection this movie will give you at the beginning, or at least that's what it did to us. We were watching and both myself and Steve went, oh, betcha that he was, you know, he was in the Revolutionary War. And this is like, because that's where the movie wants you to go at the beginning, I think, mentally. We're given hints at a case that holds, you know. And look, it's quite tropish. There's literally a box with a secret hidden within it. There's, you know, there's the voyeuristic nature of someone wanting more from life that is part of this family nucleus. It's not original content, but when you put it all together, it's kind of off kilter when you compare it to anything else that it's made today. And it's good.
What amazed me? So imagine this: I'm looking for a Western. I've played like Red Dead 2. Well, actually, I still haven't completed it, but let's not talk about that.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
I want to stay on that. No. Wait a second.
You want to say?
No, you wait. What? What'd you say?
I didn't complete Red Dead 2 yet. And shall I tell you
neither
why?
Neither have I.
You know why, mate? Because I got Red Dead 2 just before I moved to Australia, and then I moved over, and I was playing it when my son was born. Right.
Well, you get an automatic pass.
There we go. I was playing it because my Xbox didn't come with me.
I didn't finish it because priorities. Like, what the fuck?
No, but my okay, here we go.
How about being a shitty father? How about that? How about being a shitty husband? How about being a shitty teacher?
I should have sunk 100. The game. What am I doing? Right? I should have sunk 100 hours into the Rockstar.
Neglect your children and finish the game.
But I tell you, I was playing Red Dead 2 when I was in our flat in Newcastle. And then I was just mindfully like looking the other direction. And I looked to my right, and my son, who was about 7 or 8 months, was looking at the screen, put his hand on the controller, and was moving the camera for me. And I was like, oh, he's aware. Oh, I can't play Red Dead in front of him. Oh, no. So that stopped me playing Red Dead Redemption 2.
So, yeah, it's until after hours. Yeah. It's adult themed.
Oh, like, yeah, yeah. You can't just be like, he doesn't understand. He will. You know. Anyway, so
you didn't experience the bouts of fragile masculinity every time.
I got to about a third of the way through it.
Cry at all? Did you shed a tear? Because there's several tears to be shed.
Yeah, that game. There's I think yeah, there was a couple of side missions I did, which basically, again, the reason why I love Westerns is because there's a lot of course, there's a lot of tropes to Westerns, and that's what's great about this film.
Of course.
If you look at this film, there are several camera shots and there are several setups that are akin to a traditional Western. Mm. But is it a traditional Western? That's my question to you guys.
Ooh.
It isn't. Myself and Steve actually drank through this. We weren't planning to drink, but it was at one point after I drank beer, which I don't drink beer. I drink wine and spirits whenever I do drink. But in this instance, I went, you know what? Because it was 34 degrees. We changed the day in which we were going to watch this. It was 34 degrees Celsius in London. For our listeners, that is a sweltering heat akin to the flames and of hell. It's really, really hot. Okay, sure. In a city like London that's hot and humid, it's awful. So I called Steve in the middle of the day. I went, man, you're not going to sleep tonight. We're not going to be able to sleep tonight. Just come over, watch a movie tonight. And I put some beers in the freezer because I know he likes beer. He can't have it either. But that day we drank beer. And then halfway through the second beer, I just poured some whiskey. And he goes, what are you doing? And I'm like, no, we're watching Western. We need to have some whiskey. So, yeah, the following day was interesting, to say the least. Regrets. I had a few. But then again.
So what do you think makes, again, we're not going into spoiler territories at the moment, but what about this film do you think is less traditional Western than your Western?
I'm going to go Austro off the bat and say this the setup itself is very akin to being a Western. The farmer protecting his land, his kin, that kind of stuff. But the overall feel of it is more to do with almost not... You could set this in any other given time and it wouldn't be a Western. So you take the standard family trope, you take all of the extra bits, you find a body on the road, you take him home in your car, whatever. The same setup could be used for multiple films. And this works.
It does. There's one movie it made me think of a little bit as well. Maybe because of the kind of DNA shared between Tim Blake Nelson and the Coen brothers, but this felt a little bit Coen-ish, to be honest. There's a bag of money, there's circumstance at play here, there's cat and mouse, there's who can you trust in it. It's that I thought of Fargo several times when I was watching this.
Yeah.
There is one sequence, man, and that's when I turned around to Steve and immediately I said, Ricky picked it well, man. Ricky picked it well. And it's because last week we did a movie that required the viewer to suspend disbelief several times, even without earning it at the beginning. This one here did everything right. There's so much check of gun at play here and followed through as well correctly. You know what I mean? So there's a structure to this movie. It's really difficult to find flaws in the way it's constructed. But there's one sequence at the beginning that I adored. Our protagonist, Henry, finds a body, find someone injured, and the first thing he does is to aid or to begin the process of aiding this person. But then he goes after loading the body onto his horse, he goes back to where the body was to check the scene, to see how this happened. And as he's checking the scene, he finds a bag of money, He goes through it. He finds a gun. He does all of this in a very methodical manner. And then there's a very strange shot, which is kind of the camera is lowered to the ground. We see his legs walking away from this scene. And we see that he's left the satchel on the ground. The camera stays there. 5 to 10 seconds go by, and then he goes back. And I adore that. I love the fact that he goes, I'm not taking the money. But then in reality, the reality of the world we live in is, who the fuck says no to money? But it's not automatic. It's not automatic. And it's one of the most nuanced choices that the director and the writer, which is the same person, have made here. Because this happens right at the beginning. And I turned around to Steve and I went, oh shit, we're in for a ride. Mm-hmm. I love that. I loved how much plausibility it brought to the to a tale that could be classified, actually, that it is larger than life. Mm-hmm. Because it is about Billy the Kid.
Oh.
I hope. No. Yes. Yeah. I did tell people to stay away from this. But now, another point to be made. And, you know, I refer to the nebulous nature of American folklore, American mythology, American history. You can actually... When it comes down to those 200 years, there's a lot that it's kind of steeped in folklore. You know, it's steeped in hearsay and all of this. This movie is about Henry McCarthy. Henry McCarthy was the registered name for Billy the Kid. He went by an alias as well, and that alias was William H. Bunny. Both names are mentioned in this movie, but the idea is that myself, Steve, maybe, I don't know about you, Ricky, as much as I am infatuated with this historical period and with the fiction that it spawned, anything from Leone, anything from John Huston, anything, regardless of that, and even other mediums, like I have loads of games, like board games, like Western Legends, which is an incredible work of love because they did so much research. You mentioned in the video game world, the Red Dead series as well. So much research goes into making this interactive forms of entertainment. And a lot of research goes behind it as well. So we must have heard these names before, but I didn't have it in my head. So until this is revealed in the movie, old Henry was not Billy the Kid. And when it happened, both myself and Steve went,
But I think that's because of the pacing of this film and the red herrings it throws left, right, and center. That when I first watched it, I did the same thing as well. I was like, oh, is it Billy the Kid? Like, if Billy the Kid survived against Pat Garrett, and then they kind of explain it like, oh, you and Pat Garrett were friends and you got off on it and all of that stuff. But what I want to hark back to, like, what makes this a Western but not a Western?
Before you move away from this, so remember where you were going to start, the thread you were going to start. Also, once you know this, obviously now we have to do our research and everything, and it makes the movie even more fascinating because the timeline we are given at the beginning of this movie is 1906. And at the beginning of this podcast, we did say that old Henry is 47 years old. How do we know that? Because allegedly, Billy the Kid was recorded and buried. He was recorded as dead, all right, and buried in New Mexico in 1881. This means that our protagonist in 1906 would be 47 years old, but it also means that he spent 25 years in anonymity. Because Billy the Kid was not a hero. He was wanted. He was wanted for 9 murders, hence why he went by many names. And by a stage of his life, later on, he wasn't even known by McCarthy anymore because he had to kind of change his name. So his alias was William H. Bunny, and then he racked up more stuff, more bounties on his head on that as well. So the Billy the Kid thing became the hearsay that he kind of leaned into because it was the only way to remain anonymous. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the fictional part of this movie is stipulating that he never got killed in 1881, or he faked his death perhaps, because that's the best way to fade into anonymity and try and change your life. Because, you know, if he was 47... this means that by age 25 or 26, that's it. He didn't have it in him anymore because you're living on the run. So that's the interesting part of all of this when it comes down to the juxtaposition of what if This is a what if story. This is what this is, basically. That's it.
Yeah, and it leads into, there was a conspiracy theory at the time as well. It's a very well documented. So this is what this whole movie leans into. But going back to what makes this a Western but not a Western, Steve's hit on a few points, you know, farmer by themselves, a posse surrounding, trying to get something out of the house that's in the house. But there's the scene at the end where I swear it uses so many of Leone's camera positioning and shots. There's a wide angle over the house just to see all the dead bodies. You know, there's like these like sudden like crash zooms out of nowhere just to show like a knife diving into someone's chest. There's the whole juxtapositions from you're following one of the gunmen, but then all of a sudden you see from their point of view as they get shot in the face. There is just so much about this that is so classic Western that this is why when you said, we've got to do a Western next week, I was like, Old Henry, we've got to do Old Henry. Oh my God, right. Old Henry is a classic Western without being a classic Western. We already fucking
told you we're right. How many times do you want to hear it? I know you enjoy it, but you want to jerk off now while we say it in unison? Now, there is one thing that it left me wanting in this movie. You mentioned the final confrontation scene at the end of this, which is the climatic kind of, you know, adrenaline shot you get before, you know, the typical Western ending of this, which is bittersweet. But, you know, nobody rides off into the sunset. They trot into it, perhaps to a better life, but do they? You don't know, right? Ideally, though, what I would have wanted in that confrontation sequence, and the fact that it didn't happen, I was complaining. I was like, why didn't they do that? Well, I'll tell you why they didn't do that, because it's fucking difficult. I wanted the entire fucking going around the house when Old Henry is taking them all out, one take. I would want that in one take, because there's cuts, and I was like, Steve, I turned up to Steve, and I went, are we going to get this in one long continuous take? Like, is it gonna... And when it cut, I was like, oh, no.
Oh, come on.
From a technical standpoint, mate, it's very difficult to do.
But not only that, there's a point where he kills someone else, and then he jumps backwards through a window. What more do you want?
No, I know. It's very good, but it would have, because it reminded me of, there's one, just the way this, maybe because of the layout of the house, but it reminded me of that long continuous take in.
John Wick.
No. Slasher movie from the Halloween. point of view of the killer.
That came out last year.
Movies. That I adored, actually.
Oh yeah, in a violent nature.
In a violent nature? Is that what it's called?
In a violent nature.
Yeah. Phenomenal. I actually fantastic. People don't like that, don't talk to me. It's fine. You don't know anything about anything. It's fine. But
yeah,
did anybody recognized did anybody recognize Max Arciniega, aka Crazy Eight from season one of Breaking Bad in this?
Yeah.
I'm gonna mention something else as well. There's the guy who's actually credited or uncredited as the Cowardly Gunslinger. He's the Master of Arms on the movie, Kent Shelton.
Really?
Yeah, he's doing an uncredited section. And which is really cool. And he gets, it's that house section where he gets absolutely shot to shit.
This is the beginning of things to fucking come. He's going to talk about all the fucking guards.
No, let's delay a little bit. Because we're on that section.
Let me do the other cameo, the big cameo. So you guys may not know Trace Adkins.
Of course we do.
Of course you do. The reason I know him is because I only knew him because I used to watch The American Apprentice, which now we don't talk about The American Apprentice for obvious reasons. But he was one of the winners of The American Apprentice, like season 3 or 4. And that's how I knew about his country music career. Hey.
What the fuck is this?
Yeah, Trace Adkins, the big guy.
Brother-in-law.
Brother-in-law.
Oh, the guy that I thought was Donald Logue.
So I didn't recognize him at first, but yeah, he's a country western guy.
Yeah, you could actually, if you
and The Apprentice, and he's done so many. Apprentice,
yeah,
doing what?
He was a contestant. Yeah, just like what's his name? Michaels. Lead singer of Poison.
Shane Michaels.
Sexy, I've got the looks that drives the girls wild. I've got the moves that really move them. I said chill up and down their spine. I'm just a sexy boy.
Sexy boy.
I'm not your boy toy.
Boy toy.
I'm just a sexy boy.
Sexy boy.
I'm not your boy toy.
Brett Michaels.
No, Shane Michaels. That's Brett Michaels.
Did you say Brett Michaels?
Brett Michaels. No. Yes. Brett Michaels. Is it Brett Michaels?
Brett Michaels is a fucking wrestler.
No. You've got Shawn Michaels mixed up with Brett the Hitman Hart. How dare you? How long have we been friends and you still don't know your WWE history?
Okay, WWE. It's Brett Michaels. Brett Michaels is a single poison.
Yeah, but there you go.
Yeah, Brett Michaels.
I was right.
Yeah. Well done.
Cue a Poison song.
We both lie silently still in the dead of the night. Although we both lie close together, we feel miles apart inside. Was it something I said or something I did? Did my words not come out right? Though I tried not to hurt you, though I tried.
Oh, God,
but
no.
I guess
every rose has its thorn.
Oh, there we go.
God.
God.
A little bit of unknown history from my point of view. I used to play for a glam band, and that was one of the first tracks we covered.
Oh my God. Dude, if you find the
that was a
photo,
band called Ego Trip.
Wait. What were you doing in the band? Were you keyboards?
I was playing bass.
You were playing bass? Okay. Yeah. All right. Did you do backing vocals?
No.
Oh, mate.
No.
Because I was hoping you would join in on me doing Every Rose.
Every Rose has its own. Oh, my God.
Now we're talking about bands we were in. What was the first cover song of one of the main cover songs of one of the bands you were in?
Knocking on Heaven's Door, but the Guns N' Roses version.
Right, let's go.
Knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door.
Wah, 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 wah. Wah.
Fuck you for this. Oh.
Which leads us to Young Guns, because obviously Billy the Kid in Young Guns. And
Mama.
Possible.
All right.
What are you saying, Steve? Every time he starts a sentence, I'm just kidding.
Oh, it's all right. So, but that leads us to Young Guns. Fuck you. Because part three is
taking
in
a
works.
Sip, mate.
Holy fucking shit.
Oh, that reminds
Go on,
me.
Steve. Come on, keep trying.
Fuck you. Very much.
What do you want to say? What were you saying?
By the way, if you say it like Maynard, it's...
So, Young Guns Part 3, because that features Billy the Kid, and that's going to be coming out possibly in...
Yeah, so I don't remember... I had to read this up. I didn't remember the timelines of Young Guns, and I feel like we're probably going to do Young Guns in the future, but... The first Young Guns is like early on in Billy the Kid's history.
Yeah.
The second Young Guns, I completely forgot it was a flashback episode.
Yeah, you remember who played Billy the Kid in Young Guns?
Yeah, it's Emilio.
Emilio!
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 Emilio! So who play? Anyway, we're going off topic here. Anyway, let's go back to this film. I love Stephen Dorff in this. I feel like this is a mark of Stephen Dorff getting better.
Yes, definitely. But he gets to do what the director obviously is doing with this film, because there's a heavy, heavy homage to Goodfellas in this. Whenever it's because it's the only person that did the shot before. That's it. So everything that came after it, nobody placed the camera like that in a movie before. It was Scorsese did it, and every other time you see it, it's an homage to Goodfellas. Whenever you see Tommy, whenever you see Joe Pesci and De Niro kicking the shit out of someone on the ground, it's that kicking shot where the cameraman is laying on the ground and it's just pointing the camera up. So it's like, what does it look like when you're being kicked to death when you're laying on the ground? What does it look like to experience being kicked while you're down? And in this movie, Stephen Dorff does that kick when you see the leg coming in and out of frame and you see that knee bobbing up and down with violent, like in a violent nature. It's, and when we saw that immediately, we both looked at each other. Steve was here. I went, see what this is, right? See what this is. Yeah. But even the nature of the kind of sadistic, all of the characters in this, the violence when it's perpetrated with, there's very little emotion going into it. It's more like experience driving it.
Yeah.
It's getting to the point. Even there's the aspiring nature of someone younger wanting to get to that point, which is, you know, the kid in this case, with Billy the Kid's son.
Wyatt.
It's a shame that some things kind of hit twice a little bit, effectively. But the first time we see this, because of the purposeful kind of point to the violence, because it's not just mindless. Even if it comes across as being sadistic, there's a lot of purpose behind why it's being carried on. In this particular instance, with the opening sequence of this movie, and we see Stephen Dorff kicking the shit out of this guy. He's not only kicking him while he's down; he's kicking him on a wound. Shot him, and his kick, because he's trying to extract information from him, and it's done gradually. We see a subversive take on that later. That's the sequence that I was referring to earlier, which was possibly my favorite one of the most innovative things I've seen in a Western, actually, was the subversive quality of, is he helping him, or he's helping him, but he's also extracting information out of it? Because there's a sequence when old Henry is trying to get information from the guy who's helping, because now he's realizing that the guy who is actually helping has an ulterior motive. He's not the person he's saying he is, you know, and he wants information, but at the same time he's trying to keep him alive. And I love that sequence, because he's trying to extract a bullet out of the guy to save his life, but he's also it's torturous. And he's asking the questions at the right time. Do you remember the sequencing question?
Yeah, totally.
He's literally taking something out of him.
Yeah, but one of the...
He's literally taking something out of him.
Taking something out of him on several levels. But what's great about that is... So I keep thinking to myself, when do you start feeling the Henry revealing who he really is to his son? And a lot of people will probably say, like, earlier on, when he's sort of, like, telling him, like, don't do this, we got to do this, I'll go get the doctor, all of that stuff. Or like when he's like sneaking and he's very vigilant of the posse looking for him. But for me, it's when his son's in trouble and is about to get stabbed in the neck and he just comes in, kicks him in the face, and without hesitation does exactly the same thing Stephen Dorff's character does at the start of the film. He aims at the wound, he kicks the crap out of that wound, and then picks up a shotgun without hesitation. It's all very matter of fact.
Methodical. It's very methodical. And it's also like, it's really methodical, because it's like, I don't have to wound you any further. This is a time in which you didn't have surgical procedures that we have today. You didn't have an ER department. You didn't have any of this. So if you're shot, if you already kind of, it's a struggle. You know, you may not make it already. So, of course, if I need to inflict any more damage, then you do it on the existing one without. So I get it. I never thought about it in those terms, but it's clever. It's clever and it makes perfect sense. But you need to be thinking through it. And the only way you're going to think through an emotion is going to stay out of it is if it happens several times over and over. Like if you're a soldier or if you were an outlaw. So in this case, it's all plausible. Yeah. I have never suspended this belief here. We only did once, and Steve can say when.
When what?
It was during a shootout. And you said something, and it's the only time something stupid has happened in this movie.
I can't even remember, man.
I felt like Wyatt, every Wyatt move towards the end of the movie, I said, what are you doing?
Who's Wyatt?
The boy, the son.
Wyatt. It's the other guy. He walks basically right in front of a fucking window. And Steve
Curry
said, what are you doing?
Curry,
you remember that?
Idiot.
Yes.
Yeah,
so
Steve
basically
pointed it out, and I was almost upset. I was like, what are you, why are you taking me out of this shootout? With sense. Why are you being sense?
You're right. But one key thing about Westerns, when we look at Westerns, not just Westerns themselves, but when people in the Wild West were shooting, you would find cover. You would go for cover. You'd shoot out because if you're in the middle of the street, you're dead. That's it. Full stop.
Doesn't matter. Top Secret has ruined every shootout through a window for me forever.
Yeah.
Fucking tic-tac-toe. You remember that? Was it Top Secret?
Top Secret.
Was it Top Secret, Ricky?
Yeah, it was.
The shootout through the window? Yeah. You don't remember?
But I will go back because we were discussing the kind of ideas of when we start seeing where he's from and what he's doing is when he picks up the body. He looks at the gun, picks up the gun. He
checks how many shots were fired.
Yeah. He looks at the body, sees the gun wound. He packs the wound with mud from the earth to try and basically stop it and cool it down. But it's not just that. Once he grabs the bag, that sequence where he goes back and grabs it, after that one section, he covers his tracks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's when you start going, there's something else with this guy. Mm-hmm. He actively knows to cover his tracks with a branch and get rid of the hoofs prints.
Yeah.
Who is he trying to cover this from? Immediately, that's the first question. From the law or from... But because he does it regardless.
Yeah.
But you'll know that the character's trying to work out who's after this guy, if it's the law or... So Henry's, you know, he has enough experience that he basically knows something's up from the beginning. I also liked the juxtaposition of getting the uncle out of the equation with a good excuse, because the main character, protagonist, needs to be left to his own devices for this story to change, because he's been doing this for 25 years in this scenario. It would have been easier. And in fact, that's a pivotal point in the movie. The fact that that element is removed, the guy that he needs there, which is his brother-in-law, the family nucleus is weaker. Otherwise, you wouldn't have had this story working as much. You need to have him removed. And that's that exposition was given to us at the beginning. He goes, where are you going? I'm going on a hunting trip. And a hunting trip lasted fucking 3 days back then, or 2 days, or whatever it was. If you went, you went. You know, you stayed overnight because you had to go far away from where people lived if you wanted to hunt well. So it's, you know, you need him to leave. You need that character to leave for this to become a struggle, because otherwise it would have been too easy for them.
Yeah.
If you, you know.
Do you think, and I know we're jumping around here, but and I think, you know what, that marks out how good this movie is. You can jump around in this movie because your brain's constantly going, that was great, and this...
You say jump around one more time, man.
Anyway, that Stephen Dorff's character was almost like Henry Fonda in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. That whole
wearing black.
Oh, and that line he says when Al, Trace Adkins, gets knocked out, it's like, great, now we're going to have to carry him. It's so good. So much about this film that is great. Now, I want to move to one topic, though. I watched this film being a dad. So this film hit me hard. Like, to an extent
that... The fuck's your son going to find in the box? Pokemon cards?
But it's not... It's that last couple of lines where it's like, oh, you know, like, it's a really hard world out there. You got to find your feet. I hope that I've taught you well to, like, get out there and just do. You know, it is, as you said, a father-son story. This movie is brilliant because it comes from... This whole movie is from a son's point of view. If you follow the film, it's all done from Wyatt's point of view. There's so much of it, like, and I've got to admit, I have watched this film now 4 times. And recently, in this past week, I've watched it twice. Nice. When I watched it the other night, I fell asleep in the last 5 minutes of the film. So today, I was like, oh, I best watch that last five. You know what? Screw it. I'm going to start from the beginning again. And I watched this film again today. But and every time I was like, oh, maybe I'll fast forward it and just get to the bit. No. There's so much about this film that I adore. And especially noticing it these last 2 times, that it is shot all from Wyatt's point of view. That most of this film, not the intro and not the stuff with the posse, but every time Wyatt's involved, it's all from his point of view. He is looking on to who he thinks is a dad who's past it, a dad who's like not got anything left in him, a dad who's not modern. And he thinks, I've got to escape from this. And this movie just not only vindicates his dad, but it basically gives him the tools to know that there's so much more I need to know in my life. There's so much more I need to move on. And yeah, as a dad, like, this hit hard. So
Tim Blake Nelson, well, basically in all the interviews, he's turned around and said that as a father, he enjoyed the script, not only because it would center him and give him the tools to what he wanted to do with a movie, but also because it's a father and son situation. And he wanted to explore that as a father, because every single day is a teaching situation for in that sense, you know. And I believe that he found what he wanted to do, and he's portrayed the part really well. And I think I have to say this, that with Gavin Lewis as Wyatt, it's really good. It's really, really, really good. I mean, just that idea of going into his history, trying to find more about his father, but also not at the same time.
Yeah. And then on top of all of this, like, the one thing I've got to say about their relationship is their growth that happens throughout this relationship. It not only improves, but actually you start seeing the areas where Henry, Tim Blake Nelson's character, feels like he's let Wyatt down. You know, Wyatt's like, I need to know how to shoot a gun. Everybody knows how to shoot a gun. And he's just looking on to him being like, but if I teach you how to shoot, you will be me. Yeah. And again, once you know it's Billy the Kid, he's just trying to save him. He's constantly just trying to save him throughout the film. And as much as Gavin Lewis's character, Wyatt, makes bad decisions because he's a kid, he doesn't know, he's not worldly or anything.
There's a moment at the beginning where when they're digging the trench, where Wyatt's basically berating his father, and there's Trace Adkins as Al basically turns around and says one little pointy thing, if you'd only know, kind of situation. And you know, and he doesn't know, and that's the key thing. He doesn't know. We all get that because we watch enough films. I mean, like...
Also, our age. I think I felt more from Henry's side than... Actually, I found the kid to be quite annoying in bits.
The kid was a kid.
I couldn't relate to him at all.
So that's it. The kid was a kid. The kid was Luke Skywalker in episode 4. You know, he was a whiny kid who just wanted to escape. That's it. So for me, it's that kind of same situation where like I concentrated more on Tim Blake Nelson as Henry, but also we understand movies enough to see this kind of thing. I kid you not, if somebody hit one of my cats, I would kill them. I would go after them. I would hunt them down and kill them.
And on cue, the cat came.
This is Maury. But yeah.
They know. They know. You would.
Yeah. Yeah.
Daddy said, "What the daddy would do? What for me? Yeah, stab somebody 20 times in the chest against the wall of my house. Yeah, I'll do that. Yeah, cool.
Yeah, that's fine."
But yeah, and I think this all led from the fact that with Wyatt, a large percentage of this film is done from his point of view, and that's why this film, even when you know the ending, you still feel that revelation towards the end that it is Billy the Kid, because you watch it does very well giving you as much information as Wyatt gets. So, yeah, again, great film, just amazing. Love this.
Yeah.
The whole film is centered upon not only grief, but the fact that nobody moves on. The reason, you know, the fact that
you mean Curry, Scott Hayes?
Yeah, the fact that Curry turns up and he can't move on from the fact that you're Billy the Kid. It doesn't matter that he's helping him. Oh. It doesn't matter that any of this is going on. He's just constantly super hyper-focused on the fact that you're Billy the Kid. The fact that Tim Blake Nelson can't move on from the fact that I'm bringing up a boy without his mother. The fact that Wyatt can't move on from I can't be under this roof anymore. I need to spread my wings. It's all about just not being able to let go. And it's such a beautiful metaphor around grief, around the change of times, around modernization. It's so good. It's just, you know, chef's kiss.
If there's one interesting fact as well with this, I mean, there's no single female in this movie other than the grave.
Yeah.
And the grave is basically white stone. It's going to be expensive. I mean, for that time and place, you don't build a white stone grave.
But have we given ammunition to like certain listeners to be like, oh, this film is just got male characters. How dare it? Oh, and it's a male writer.
It's the simple fact that there's the idea of loss.
Yeah.
A loss of self, a loss of love, and the loss of money. Really? I mean,
and this is why it's such a traditional Western. There's so much about it that is like, what happens to males when they're left to their own devices? They become liars, they become thieves, they become cheaters, or they become solitude and don't want to connect with people.
Which is what he's done.
Mm.
And basically, he's out there digging a ditch, you know? But the... good digging his own ditch, really.
I didn't even think about that. Like metaphorically, they're digging a ditch, and they're digging a ditch.
Yeah, exactly. It's really. It's.
And that's the thing. If you ever meet anybody out there that says, "Oh, I saw Old Henry," and it's like, "Oh, you just like it for like that uber violent bit towards the end," I'm like, that uber violent bit is like the cherry on the cake. There's so many other layers to eat through. That cherry on the cake is the uber violent ending.
That's the bit you save to the end, just to taste it on, you know, that's the glacial cherry of this cake.
It's like, I am so full from all of this content, and now I'm going to try and shove a cherry in as well.
Exactly, yeah. And I love that. I mean, like, I grew up watching Westerns with my father. So for me, this was a welcome respite and going back to something that was always on in the house. It's that feeling for me.
Do you think that's also this film as well, why it works so well for especially people like us, because the Western genre is normally shared from father to son, and this is a Western about father and son.
Yeah, I think that is possibly the case. But when we look at the situation now, in comparison to then, I mean, if you look at the 50s and Americana and Wild West, and even going back a little bit further, where most of it was Westerns, they were the big thing of the time. Mm-hmm. And now what we have is superhero movies.
Yeah.
And are the superhero movies going to be the new Westerns?
Well,
for the next age.
Technically they are, because the people who have younger children are now the comic book readers. They're the ones who understand that comic books are a true form of literacy or a true form of historical literature.
Yeah.
As, you know, the great American novel or the great British anecdote or any of this stuff, poetry. We know now that comic books can be regarded as literature much as any novel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I kid you not, as some comic books are so touching and so vividly honest with things in the world. I mean, you just got to take the Marvel superheroes from the 1960s, where introducing kids as kids, you know, with Spider-Man, Peter Parker was an average kid.
Or if you look at the history, if you look at the history of the X-Men,
yeah,
you know, the history of the X-Men is all about apartheid and revolution and segregation.
Yeah. Yeah. And this kind of situation, we're modern myths. That's what we come from. Yeah. And when we look at myths, the Wild West was full of myths.
Yeah.
And legends.
And going back to this.
Hence Billy Kidd.
Yeah. Billy the Kid is one of the greatest mythologies, up there with Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. An extent that after finishing this, I didn't realize that there is another Billy the Kid like biopic movie out there, directed by Vincent D'Onofrio, that's on Disney Plus.
I know this because I started watching it this morning.
Oh, did you? I totally think that is going to be the next film I watch for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
It's ratings time. So, this was very, very, very good. I quite enjoyed it. It was nice to see Stephen Dorff actually just not being hammy as he's been lately, at least. Team Blake Nelson is definitely a highlight. What's the name of the guy that plays the dude that gets rescued, basically?
Scott Hayes.
Scott Hayes. Yeah.
His performance was good as well. Very good as well. The action and reaction and the interplay between him and Team Blake Nelson is stellar. I really love that sequence at the table when he's feeding him, basically. I thought that was another highlight of this movie, as he's trying to extract information again. You probably guessed I've talked about it. I don't think it's going to be one of those movies that I watch again, because it's pretty memorable the first time around. I was also surprised by, you know, Henry being Billy the Kid. I highly recommend it to our listeners. It's a Western that is memorable enough to be remembered, exactly that. So it's an 8, and it's an 8 satchels of cash. That's what that is.
Nice. Who do you want to go next? Do you want to go next, Ricky?
No, because you're 9.5. You go first, because I'm just going to gush.
I know you are, because we've just had a conversation about you gushing so much. So, this movie kind of holds a special point in my with me. Remembrance. Father-to-son situation. The shared idea of movies, which my father would have loved this. And sadly, because this was shot through COVID, my father never got a chance to watch this movie. And with myself and my father, we sat down every Sunday, watched a Western. And this, again, is about family. It's about a son and father situation. And it's very touching in that sense. But also, it's a very good movie. And it's going into my watch list for however long it sits there. And I'm giving it an 8.5. And I'm going to give it an 8.5 Winchester model 1892 carbines, which is a gun that is used by Henry.
Very well reserved to talk about guns this late on in the show. Well done.
I know. Especially since this is full of them. And I mean, like, there's a lot. And I will say one thing. Every single gun is accurate to the time.
Very accurate, yeah.
Very accurate to the time.
Okay. Well, I mentioned earlier that this is a very layered film. There's so much to consume. I would actually applaud Umbar at some point. Rewatch it and just allow the see how many more layers you notice next time around. As much as this is a memorable film, I've now watched it 4 times in a year, and that every time I put it on, I feel so glad about cinema. And I am giving this a 9.5. You know, don't you find it worrying that they eat their own? Pigs eating their own.
Pigs eating their own. How to get rid of a body 101.
Yeah, pigs eating their own. We trained them well.
And on that note, this was Umba.
This is Steve.
This is Ricky.
What's a dad for, dad? Tell me how to stand, dad. Took me by the hand and you show me how to be a bigger